Hello, I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, with a series of interviews with contributors to New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. It's available online, www.newmalestudies.com. But are the kids really all right? Is the question posed in another article in the first edition of New Male Studies, an international journal. The two authors in this interview hold the belief that the underlying but disguised premise of a widely acclaimed recent movie, The Kids Are All Right, is that children really do not need a father. To explore this further, I spoke via Skype in December 2011 to Dr. Catherine Young, Professor Emerita at the Faculty of Religious Studies, McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and Dr. Paul Nathanson, also from the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University in Montreal. I began by asking Dr. Paul Nathanson about the film The Kids Are All Right.
Well, that film came out at the very moment, at the height of the controversy in the States over same-sex marriage. Basically, I mean, it's a well-made film, high production values, top stars, but for all that, I would basically classify it as political propaganda. The story is about two women who are married, or I think they're married, or maybe they're just living together. They have a sperm donor who has, with their sperm donor, they have produced two children, a boy and a girl. The boy and the girl decide that they want to find the sperm donor and just find out something about the man who had at least a minimal amount to do with their existence. And they do find him, and he turns out to be an interesting, charismatic sort of man. He eventually meets the two mothers, one of whom has a kind of affair with him, and the other woman is kind of very put off by him. She sees a threat to her relationship with the other mother. In the end, they send the guy packing, and the children decide that they really don't need him in their lives at all. And so the message of the movie is that children do not need the father. They need two mothers can do the same job as well as or better than a man and a woman. As I say, that came out at a politically notable moment, and it had an effect. I mean, it was a huge success. And so that's the background of that movie.
In a way, this film is challenging those very traditional ideas we have of the ideal family.
That's right. Well, in fact, it's challenging the idea that there is any such thing as an ideal family, because the dominant way of thinking about this, certainly in academic circles, but also filtering down through Oprah Winfrey and the talk shows, is that we live in a world of what used to be called alternative families. I mean, just any kind of family unit is as good as another, and there's no point in perpetuating any kind of traditional family.
I mean, I think, again, a historical perspective is always important. Just about every human society, I think, in the historical record, had some view of marriage as a norm. In other words, these ideals can change from culture to culture. You have polygamy in some cultures, you have monogamy in others, you have nuclear families in some and extended families in others. There are a number of cultural variables, but the one constant up to the modern period that we find is that marriage was between a man and a woman, and that there was always a special bonding with the nuclear family of that couple and their immediate children. But historically, it was very often in an extended family context. So we have to be careful with that word ideal. It simply means that cultures knew that to bring men and women together is a difficult situation, to bring their families together to have the next generation of children and have the relationship last long enough to bring those children to maturity takes a great deal of cultural effort. And so they created some notion of the ideal marriage that would support basically the need for reproduction to create a new generation. And that's why children figured very heavily in the early or the historical definitions of marriage.
And that's also, of course, why children are hardly mentioned in the discussion of marriage today. Marriage today is defined basically in connection with the needs of adults, usually in connection with the love of two adults for each other. Children are bystanders in this controversy over same-sex marriage, for example.
Well, there's a twist on that, though, because there's also the discussion that gay couples have children, too, and the needs of those children need to be addressed, which is true. But now we have a problem that can you address the needs of both straight couples and gay couples in the same way, or are there different issues because of the different ways that reproduction has occurred and the lifestyles exist and so forth? So there is one angle of children that comes into this.
So this, in fact, brings me back to something that I think Paul mentioned a few minutes ago, and that is that any two people will do as parents. It doesn't matter. Any two people can form this family.
Yes, in theory it says that, but in fact the movie showed two women, not two men. And I think that probably just relates to the fact that many people take for granted that women are going to be more concerned about having children, and therefore the model that they present in this movie is two women, not two men. There are, in fact, gay men who want children. That could have been the movie, but it wasn't. So in other words, it was adding to the stereotypes of women being nurturing and children-oriented and men not being.
And in point of fact, that's come into legislation now, because in some regimes, in some countries, you can't even use the word father. It's parent A and parent B, some euphemism to get away from that word father.
Which leads me to ask about two words which I'd not come across before, and you use them in your article, and they are the words degendering parenthood and then regendering parenthood. Could you comment on that?
So degendering is part of the fallout of egalitarian feminism, because the idea of equality is that we can all be the same, and if we're the same, then we're interchangeable. But that still left women with the role as of gestation and lactation and those very basics to the reproductive process. And it took that basic role, the men's role in this family process away. So degendering it then created a problem for men, because there was no identity as fathers. It wasn't a role that was viewed as essential. Any woman could do it just as well, for example.
As we say, degendering is basically the idea that we can eliminate the whole notion of gender, and with it, the notion of gender equality, which is so problematic. If there's no gender at all, then there can be no gender inequality. The other perspective is regendering. In other words, now, that this is a problematic idea, because if regendering means simply restoring some earlier gender system, then we're just going back, we're not solving any problem, because if the old gender system was so good, then why did people rebel against it? So what we're suggesting is not so much we're not restoring an earlier gender system, but revising any gender system so that at the very least it serves the needs of both men and women. And if that means allowing men some distinctive role in society, then we have to do that. Otherwise, we can't have a society. Now, some societies give men very token symbolic roles. There are societies in which men are said to be keepers of the sacred blowpipe. Okay, so they have little rituals and they keep their blowpipe, and that's about the extent of what masculinity means. In other societies, of course, it goes much too extreme in the opposite direction, in which you have basically men with extreme power over everybody else. The role of men has to be a distinctive, in other words, something that is not what women do. It has to be necessary, in other words, it has to be visibly useful to society as a whole, a contribution that men can make, and C, it has to be publicly valued. Everybody has to acknowledge, men and women have to acknowledge that this is a necessary and distinctive role. We've got to come up with that, and I don't know how we're going to do that, because we're all very self-conscious now about gender. It's not like it was 500 years ago when people simply acted on tradition without thinking analytically about what they were doing. So I don't know we don't know the answers to all these questions, but we do know that that is one thing that must happen. So to that extent, we would recommend regendering, not restoring, but allowing both sexes to have a distinctive, necessary, and publicly valued role.
So why do young people need a father?
Well, we think that there are two reasons. There are two messages that children need to hear, and they are both different enough that if they come from the same person, they tend to be contradictory. One of them is the message of unconditional love. I will love you no matter what you do, no matter what you don't do, I will always love you. The other message is you need to earn respect in the larger world and in the family. Unconditional love has been usually assigned to mothers, and the second message, earned respect, has been assigned to men. Now, in theory, you know, you could argue that, well, men could do either and women could do either. At the moment, of course, we're not there yet. We have not had courses on fatherhood for women or motherhood for men. So at the moment, we have a male parent to give one message and a female parent to give the other. And so the children don't get mixed up. They don't get double messages there from one person. So that's one factor. The other factor is we're all embodied beings. We have bodies, male or female bodies. And we think that children need a same-sex parent to tell them about what it means to be either male or female. At the same time, they need an opposite-sex parent to tell them what the opposite sex will expect of them. So this is why we say that children do need a parent of each sex. Catherine and I really would like to make it clear to everyone that our problem is not with feminism as such. We have a problem with egalitarian feminism only to the extent that it has unwittingly created problems. The goal of equality is a noble one. The fallout, the unwitting result, has been that men have no function. But that's not because anybody was trying to do that. We have a problem with ideological feminism, on the other hand, because that has intentionally focused hostility on men. So we do make that distinction, and I think that needs to be clear.
So how do we go about making fathers more valued?
Well, one thing is we have to get rid of the misandry that's out there. It has to be challenged. And as the women say, well, they keep seeing the misogyny arise, and probably the misandry will pop up and pop up. But if we can get it somewhat under control, that would help to provide a basis for a healthy identity, at least it gets rid of the negative stereotyping.
Another factor is we have to at least challenge the idea, this isn't necessarily misandry, but it's a prevalent idea that, you know, women can be both mothers and fathers. We have single mothers by choice, never mind single mothers who can't help it, but single mothers by choice. We've had very big cover stories in the New York Times, for example, about single mothers by choice who have no need. They see no need to have a father for their children. They're perfectly competent. These are career women. They don't need men for anything. Why should they have one in the home? So we need to challenge that, in addition to all the misandric stereotypes.
And we need good research now, because if we don't track children carefully with good social science research, and we think there needs to be longitudinal studies, because the problems may not come out in the first few years. They may occur in adolescence. So you need longitudinal studies with very good methodology that does see what the effects are on children. There's a number of studies that have been done that argue that the children of gay parents do just as well, if not better. But in point of fact, the people interviewed are usually self-select for that interview process. So that whole research needs to be done, I think, before we can talk theoretically here, but to see what the effect is on a long-term basis. If reproduction is at the heart of a lot of family traditions, will these children grow up to be reproductive adults in a healthy context, not just having children and then disappearing or abusing children, but, you know, really good hands-on parenting? And that, to me, would be one of the real tests of a successful family form. Maybe innovations in the future. Not everything stays the same, but...
At the moment, the basic notion of what a father is, I would say, is at the very best, they're considered luxuries, which is to say, assistant mothers. They help out in the home. They add a little money with their paycheck. They're luxuries. At worst, they could be burdens. They could be potential molesters. They could be runaways. They could be, you know... So these are the basic images of fatherhood that come out on television, in movies, by journalists, by politicians. You hear about all this in discussions of legislation on custody, for example. So we really have to challenge those notions.
Paul, in listening to you, I'm thinking of recent and often heated debates here in Australia, and I'm sure elsewhere, about gay marriage. Could it be said that opposition to gay marriage will look like opposition to gay relationships?
Yes, I think that it could look, it would, in fact, look like that, because the entire discussion of gay marriage has used the model of civil rights. And of course, gay people have civil rights just as any other group of people. The problem is with so many rights in any democracy is that there can be conflicting rights. And in this case, there are two conflicting legitimate rights. The legitimate right of gay adults to marry the person of their choice, and also the right of children to have fathers. And so the question is, how do you choose one side or the other? And I think that the normal moral process is that you favor the group that is most vulnerable. And children are almost by definition the most vulnerable members of any society, even more vulnerable than gay adults, although they're vulnerable too. I mean, I am gay myself, and I certainly have no problem with gay relationships or gay sex or anything else. My only question is whether we need to redefine marriage in order to solve the legal problems that gay people have. And I'm not convinced that it is necessary. Now, my point of view, and Catherine's point of view, emerges from the fact that we are convinced that children need fathers. Now, that is in itself a controversial topic. There are people who simply say, well, any two parents are good enough. And we're not convinced of that. And we've already discussed the reasons why we think children need fathers. And apart from anything else, there are no longitudinal studies have been made yet, because there has not been time to make them, on the children of gay parents. Now, the problem is not, we're not saying that gay parents cannot love their children as much as any other parents. Of course they can. The only question is loving children enough? Do they need that, or do they need that in addition to other things? And we believe that they need more than that, that they need actually a parent of each sex. So that's the context in which the discussion has been taking place here. People have, in fact, called me homophobic. And I think that really says that's a negative comment, not so much on this particular discussion, but on society as a whole. If people can't disagree without calling each other names, then the level of democracy is diminished considerably. It should be possible to have this discussion with respect for everybody involved. So our research has focused on the need of children for fathers, and also the need of fathers for children. because we think that fatherhood is probably the only remaining source of a healthy masculine identity for men. Therefore, it's not only that children need fathers, but also that fathers or men need children or need fatherhood. So that's what our discussion is about. The fact that gay parenting presents a problem is that's an anomaly. And we're certainly not opposed to gay rights. The only question is whether redefining marriage is going to get gay people what they want. And I think that it's not necessary to do that.
My guests in this program were Dr. Paul Nathanson from the Faculty of Religious Studies, McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and Dr. Catherine Young, Professor Emerita at the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University in Montreal. The full article is published in New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. It's available online, www.newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. In Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan.